We were introduced to the Tsarei Yehuda Binyamin, the enemies of Judea, really. The people who had been moved in by the Assyrians and who had occupied the northern kingdom, who still worshipped their Avodah Zarah from wherever they had lived beforehand, but who, out of fear of lions, accepted Judaism as well. But their conversion is questioned because it is a conversion under duress. And so their status is kind of intermediate. They approach the Jews who are living in who have returned, and they say, "We would like to build this temple with you." And the response of the Jews is, "Absolutely not. We don't want you with us." And we brought last time two different explanations for why we refused their participation. Explanation number one was because of fear that they wanted to damage the process. And within this view, they intended to damage it from the beginning, right? This was the view that Rashi put forth based on one view we saw in the Gemara in Erchin, that the assumption is they were always against. They always wanted there to be only temples that would include their gods, and therefore their intent was to sabotage from the beginning. That's one school of thought. The alternative school of thought is no, they wanted to build, but they wanted it to be a hybrid. They wanted it to be for us, as well as for them, for their gods. And that was the ineligibility of it, and that's why we refused. So what we saw at the end, chapter 4, sentence 5, if you take a look, if you're in the Art Scroll Tanakh, you want page 1821. Ezra Perek Dalet Pasuk Hey, chapter 4, sentence 5. In Pasuk Dalet, in sentence 4, we said that they weakened and intimidated the builders. But in sentence 5, we said, V'sochrim alayhem yawatsim la'aferat sasam. They hired lobbyists who had helped to ruin the plans of the Jews. And we'll see what the lobbyists did, hopefully in today's discussion. Kol yimei Koresh melech paras, all through the period of Cyrus, v'ad malchus Daryavesh melech paras, and through the reign of King Darius. And then in Pasuk Vav, sentence 6, gives us our first problem. U'b'malchus Achashverosh, b'schilas malchuso, in the kingdom of Achashverosh as well, the beginning of his reign, kasvu sitna al yoshvei Yehuda v'Yerushalayim, they wrote a letter to obstruct the construction as well. So we have a bunch of chronology issues that we're going to have to face as part of this conversation. But one of them, right off the bat, to quote the beginning of Megillat Esther, is Hu Achashverosh? Who? Who is this? Which Achashverosh are you actually talking about when you say, in the days of King Achashverosh? If you take a look at number 3 on your sheet, you see the chronology of the Persian kings, the secular historian's chronology. So first you have Cyrus. This is actually technically Cyrus the II, but as far as we are concerned in this book, he's the only Cyrus we know of. So I gave him no numbers. But that's your initial Cyrus, the one who rules over Babylon, and the one who licenses the Jews to return. Then you have Cambyses the II. Cambyses, according to most, doesn't appear in our books, meaning that he's a Persian king who gets no mention, not in here, not in Daniel. It's as though he never was. Then you have Darius the I, who may be the King Daryavesh we're going to talk about. Then you have Xerxes, who may be Achashverosh, as we'll see. Then you have Artaxerxes, who people associate with Artaxasta. We're going to have to come back to that as well. But the big question here is, how do I read this Achashverosh, who is obstructing, or in whose day there's an attempt to obstruct our construction? He's only going to be here. He's never going to show up again in Ezra and Nehemiah. This is his one show in Ezra and Nehemiah. And again, maybe he's the same one who's in Megillat Esther, but I don't know. So there are three different approaches that I want to show you here. And I'm not walking you through the sources on this just because this is only the mini issue. The major issue is yet to come. This is the easy one. Rashi's view is that the Achashverosh we're talking about here, in whose day the Samaritans try to halt the construction, is the one from Purim. He says that's the one of Purim, and he's between Cyrus and Darius. That's the way Rashi renders it, which makes him a fine candidate to be on the list in number 3, Cambyses II, because he's between a Cyrus and a Darius. So that's Rashi's understanding. Second understanding is Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra is very difficult. We said in the beginning of the year, when we started reading Sefer Ezra, that Ibn Ezra says multiple contradictory things regarding the identities of Persian kings. He's very hard to work with. But you should know that he thinks Ahasuerus is actually Artaxasta. They're one and the same. Which is an interesting way to do it. The other note I would give you is the Encyclopedia Mikra'it associates him with a name that we don't have an easy time pronouncing. It's harder than Ahasuerus. It goes something like Chashiarsha. Chashiarsha, which is pretty good, actually. Chashiarsha, I can do that. That is Xerxes. As in the Xerxes on our list, who's after Darius the First. So Encyclopedia Mikra'it, which is generally a secular perspective on it, thinks that that's who this Ahasuerus is, but that's not necessarily the same one as the Purim one. Now, each one gives his chronology for a particular reason, but in order to know why each one dates Ahasuerus the way they do, why you would put Ahasuerus as being between Cyrus and Darius, as Rashi does, or why you would make him Artaxasta, who's Artaxerxes later on, or why you would put him as Xerxes right after Darius, it all depends on a much, much bigger problem. And here is the problem, which we are going to spell out in a way that is going to be so clear that everyone's going to say, ha, that wasn't a problem at all, Georgina. What are you making such a big deal out of this? You'll see. Take a look on your sheet at source number 2, where I outlined the psukim in order to try to show what it is that we're talking about. The outline, as you can see, extends from the beginning of Perek Dalet of chapter 4, verses where we actually have already read, all the way up to and into chapter 7. So basically, everything we're going to cover for the next month or two is part of this confusion. What I like to think of as a royal mess, because it's a mess of royals, as you'll see. We start out saying there's opposition from the time of Cyrus to the time of Darius. Okay, I can do that. I look at my list in number 3 and say Cyrus, Cambyses, Darius. Okay, fine. Then we're told there's opposition in the time of Ahasuerus. So okay, maybe Ahasuerus is Xerxes. Right? This Kshayarsha fellow. Or maybe he's Artaxerxes. That's still okay. But then we get an entire story, a major story, about opposition in the time of King Artaxasta, which means I am now at the 5th king listed in source number 3, right? And then after that, the concluding sentence in that section says the opposition lasted until the 2nd year of King Darius. Which Darius? Sorry? Darius the Second. So one way you could look at it is it's until the 2nd year of Darius the Second. The problem with that is that it's generally assumed that the Artaxasta who's going to send Ezra, starting in chapter 7, is the first Artaxerxes, who's before Darius the Second. So in other words, that requires that you go forward in time to Darius the Second, and then you go back in time. And not only that, but it says the Jews start building, and then the opposition appeals to Darius. According to you, David, he's going to be Darius the Second. But then it says construction is permitted by the authority of Darius, Cyrus, and Artaxasta. Cyrus is long gone, if you're in the period of Darius the Second. And the temple is completed in the 6th year of Darius. Which Darius are you talking about? The problem we fundamentally have as we read through the outline in number 2 is that we seem to be jumping around in the chronology. We seem to go forward to the time of Artaxasta and then backward to the time of Darius. But then we say construction is permitted by the authority of Darius, Cyrus, and Artaxasta. So now I'm entirely confused.
Unlike us.
Well, I'm not confused anymore because I spent a lot of hours unconfusing myself on this. But believe me, I know what you're feeling.
So it's good to know that in the end we hopefully will join
you. Yes, no, you will. You will. It will all be clear. Really.
Is it possible that this was some sort of retroactive decree? They knew that he had allowed that Horus and Darius of this prior ones had also given permission that it was a continuation
Right? So Janine wants to say that chapter 6, sentence 14, construction is permitted by authority of Darius, Cyrus, and Artaxasta, goes back to the initial permission given by Cyrus, right? And there is no permission given by Darius, except that when you get to the part where he checks the records and approves the building. And then Artaxasta permits it when? When did Artaxasta permit anything? We don't have a record of Artaxasta permitting anything. So I'm stuck when I get to Artaxasta. Bruria, you're going to say? This is really confusing. How do you sort out your kings? Right? We had preparation for this already when we dealt with the earlier problem of the passage that seems to appear in Nehemiah chapter 7, but also in Ezra chapter 3. So we saw there were two different ways to read that passage. That was just basic. This is really more complicated, but we're going to get through it together. Don't worry. But our questions fundamentally are, who is Ahasuerus in 4-6? Right? We already saw a few options on that. It looks like chapter 4, sentences 7 to 23, are inserted into the middle of Darius's time, perhaps. Which Artaxasta is this? Four different solutions to our problem. We are going to see four solutions. And I actually gave you, on the flip side of the sheet, in number 9, a summary of the solutions. So, at the end, we'll be able to go through that line by line, and really, Lynette, it should be clear. The first approach that I'm bringing is the Gemara's solution. The solution of the Gemara, the solution of Medrash and Seder Olam. Rashi likes this idea. Malbin brings this idea, although he also brings other ideas. And this idea says, it's actually very concise. Take a look at number 4. Tana, it was taught. Hu Koresh, Hu Daryavesh, Hu Artaxasta. They're all the same person. Cyrus equals Darius equals Artaxasta, and that's it. They're all the same guy. Well, then why does he have three names, right? Koresh, Shemelech Kosher Haya. He's called Koresh because he is a kosher king. Like scrambling the letters. Koresh, kosher. That's the way the commentators take it. I actually wonder if that's not what it means. Meaning that all the commentators on that Gemara say it means Koresh sounds like kosher. However, I wonder if it doesn't mean something else. We talked about at the beginning of the year that Yeshaya, Isaiah, predicts there's going to be a great king named Koresh who's going to be the one who frees the Jews. And I wonder if they're not saying Koresh because he was the Melech Kosher who Isaiah predicted back then. In any case, his name isn't Cyrus. Cyrus is some kind of reference. His name isn't Artaxasta either. Artaxasta, by the way, you have to practice pronouncing Artaxasta. This is an art form. You have to work on it. Artaxasta al shem Malchusa. The first time I learned through Gemara Rosh Hashanah was with a British Chavrusa, and we just called him George. It was easier than saying Artaxasta. So Artaxasta al shem Malchusa. Artaxasta was the name given by his empire, meaning there's a pharaoh, right, who's the king of Egypt. There's an Abimelech, who's the king of the Plishtim. And the name of the king in Persia is Artaxasta. That's the title, Artaxerxes. Umashimo, but if you want to know what his mother called him, Daryavashimo, his name was Darius. That's the way that the Gemara and Medrash approach this problem. Rashi adds a note for you in number 5, which is interesting, and that is Gematria. The numerical value of letters. He says, isn't it interesting that if you spell Koresh without a vav, right? Yeah, that's part of it. That's part of making this work, yes. But it's not so unusual. I mean, sometimes it is with a vav, and maybe sometimes it's without. But the more prominent one is indeed with a vav. But in any case, he says, if you do that, then the gematria of each is 520. Koresh equals Daryavesh. Isn't that neat? Well, that just solved all our problems. We can continue from here. Rashi notes that. He's not the inventor of the idea. It's got to be a Medrash somewhere, but I saw it in Rashi. Yes?
Because I heard somebody place this on a very high level. Say them Olam Rabbah.
Yes.
How authoritative is it?
That is a very, very good question for issues far beyond what we're talking about here, because much of the confusion about the missing 165 years centers around the chronology given for the time of the Persians' destruction of the first temple, building of the second temple in Seder Olam. It is a very, very old body of Medrash, and more to the point, it gets quoted by various figures we consider halachic authorities, and the fact that they trust it is what gives us, you know, confidence in it, in this chronology. At the same time, it's a very hard chronology to sustain in a number of different ways. But that's the view of Seder Olam. Now, the benefit of this, the benefit of saying that they're all the same person, is that everything reads smoothly. You can read all the psukim in order. Because go back to our outline in number 2. Right? The ignore sentence 6 about opposition in the time of Ahasuerus. We don't deal with him in this point. But everything else works nicely. There's opposition in the time of Artaxasta. Who is Cyrus? Who is Darius? It lasts till the second year of Darius. Who is Artaxasta? Who is Cyrus? And they start building, and the opposition appeals to Darius. He checks the records. He allows it. And construction is permitted by the authority of Darius, Cyrus, and Artaxasta. Me, myself, and I. Right? It's all the same person. The obvious problem is, what do you do with actually listing all of them in chapter 6, sentence 14? We have to deal with that problem. But that's the idea. There's another problem with this, though, besides this, and Malvin points this out. The letter of opposition that's going to be sent to Darius to halt the construction is going to talk about the Jews having built up the city itself. You have to remember, and this is a key point to remember in order to keep things in order in the book, there are two stages of construction. The first stage of construction is what we started on a couple of weeks ago, which is building the Mizbeach, the altar, as a step towards building the temple itself. The second stage is what happens when Nehemiah comes back and he wants to build the walls of the city to protect Jerusalem, to protect Yerushalayim. The letter that they're going to send to Darius says, the Jews are building up the city itself and they're going to rebel. But that hasn't happened yet in the time of Darius. They don't build that. That's not until Nehemiah shows up, which is the days of Artaxasta later on. There's a limit to how far you can go and say they're all the same king. So Malvin points out this problem, and there are answers that you can give, but that's one of the problems with saying that these are all the same king. They seem to be discussing something that hasn't happened yet. And if you're going to tell me it's in the chronology, fitting in order here, then I'm going to say to you, how in the world did they ever get away with saying the Jews are building the walls? They barely built an altar. You follow the problem. So the answer to this first answer says, everything is in order. Everything is occurring early on. Ezra has not shown up yet. Right? Again, depending on how we read Nehemiah 7 last time, but ignoring that for right now. Everything is happening early on, and and it's all during this initial stage of construction that the opposition happens, and the letter is sent, and the response comes from Darius, ultimately permitting them to go forward. And the problem is, number one, I have a verse that lists Artaxasta, Darius, and Cyrus together. And number two, that the letter of opposition said they're building the walls of Jerusalem, and they're doing no such thing. Okay? Clear? That's approach number one with its pitfalls. If you look in source number 9, Artaxasta is a title, Darius is name, Koresh is an adjective. Right? That's your approach. Okay. Approach number 2, Rabbi David Altshuler, the Mitzudat David, Malbim has a similar approach, says, you're right about Artaxasta. Artaxasta is a title. It's not, no one in their right mind ever named their kid Artaxasta. It's simply the title that you give. However, what's going on in chapter 4, sentences 7 to 23, that's actually Cyrus operating under the title of Artaxasta. In other words, we haven't even gotten to King Darius. Everything that has happened since the beginning of the book has been in the time of Cyrus. He was the one who allowed them to return. He was the one who allowed them to build. The opposition comes from the Samaritans, and they are the ones who send a letter to Artaxerxes in chapter 4, sentence 7 to 23, trying to prevent the construction, and that's going to last until the second year of King Darius, who we're going to get to. So he also preserves the chronological order. The only thing he's not doing is saying that Cyrus equals Darius. He's saying Cyrus is Artaxerxes, and then Darius in his own day will be Artaxerxes. That's the way that he deals with it. He's going to have the same problem of chapter 6, sentence 14, saying Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes. That you have not solved. That's still not going to work. So Artaxerxes is a title for each of these kings. He's also not dealing with the problem of a letter that refers to building the walls at a time when they're not building the walls. That also hasn't been solved. The only advantage of the approach of Mitzudat David over the approach of the Medrash is that he has decoupled Cyrus and Darius. They're now two different people. Which makes me sleep a little bit better. Because having them be all three is really hard to work with. But that's your second approach. Clear? I wrote it in number 9. Your second approach, Artaxerxes, is a title. Chapter 4, sentences 7 to 23, is Cyrus as Artaxerxes. And then chapter 7, which we'll get to when he sends Ezra, is a later Artaxerxes, is a later king operating under that name. And everything is happening in order. We keep the chronology of the book. Then we get to the Baal HaMa'or. Rabbi Zrachya Halevi is usually not known for commentary on Tanakh. Rabbi Zrachya Halevi appears, if you ever look at a volume of Talmud in the standard Vilna edition, you have your Gemara, you have your commentaries that appear in the back of the Gemara, and then after that you have the Rif. The Rif is Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. He went through the Gemara in the late 10th, early 11th century, and took all of the halachic passages that appear in the Gemara, all the conclusions, and presented that as a digest. It's before you have works of Jewish law. So if I want to know what the law is, and skip all the dialogue, and skip the rejected views, I can just read what he did. It appears in the back of the Gemara. There are commentaries on the side and on the bottom. And one of the commentaries on Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi's work is the Baal HaMa'or, written by Rabbi Zrachya Halevi. Like I said, he's not usually known for discussions about Tanakh. However, he comments on that passage in the Talmud that says Koresh equals Darius, Ita equals Artaxerxes. And first he goes through a long discussion about how that can work and how that can make sense. And then he says, but it's not pshat. That's not the simple read of the sentences. And I brought you in number 7 what he does say. He says, Zehu ha'ole biyadenu. This is what emerges, l'fi medrash rabbeinu l'fi diktukehen, this business of them all being the same, this is the way it works if you follow the medrash and its analysis. Aval, however, ha'perish ha'nachon l'fi apshat, he says, the simple read of the sentences is, zesha kasuv, when the sentence is going to say, that mitaim koresh v'daryavish artaxerxes melech paras, by the order of Cyrus Darius Artaxerxes, shlosha malachim hayu, those were three separate kings. Artaxerxes is somebody's name. V'hareyu k'mo sh'amar malchei paras. It's as though, even though it said melech paras, king of Persia, it means kings. These were all kings of Persia. Ki kol echad mehem haya melech paras, because each of them was a king of Persia. V'ashnayim harishonim huzkru le'inyan binyan abayis. The first two are mentioned in reference to permitting the construction of the temple. Cyrus began the permission and then Darius completed it. And beside them it mentions Artaxerxes HaMelech HaAcharon. The last one listed is King Artaxerxes Shahu Bana Chomos Yerushalayim, who built the walls of Jerusalem. He's not the one who prohibited the construction. Meaning, go back to source number 2. The way that he is going to read this is also going to preserve the chronological order of our text. He says, Cyrus, in the beginning, is the one up until chapter 4, sentence 5. Then, there's opposition in the time of King Artaxerxes, and that's what you read about in chapter 4, sentences 7 to 23. That's your second one. Then you have Darius in chapter 4, sentence 24. And then After that, in chapter 7, you have a different Artachshasta who sends Ezra. In other words, what Rabbi Zrachya Halevi is doing is what Rabbi Ostriker wanted to do before. He's forcing you forward. The only way this works, if you look at our list of kings in source number 3, is that it's Cyrus first, then you are jumping to Artachshasta the first, Artaxerxes the first, then Darius the second, in whose day you complete the construction of the temple, and then Artaxerxes the second or third is the one who sends Ezra. You follow? Yeah, he's gone. Don't worry about him. We're ignoring him. He only appears in one sentence in our book anyway. He doesn't take into consideration Ahasuerus.
Also, Darius the first.
Yeah, Darius the first gets leapfrogged. Darius the first gets leapfrogged. Darius the second is the Darius that we're interested in, according to this.
So, no Darius first.
Nothing happens in the days of Darius the first. Everything is quiet.
Okay.
What this does is it preserves the chronology. You started out with Cyrus, everything was good. The Jews came back, they wanted to build. There is no opposition from the Samaritans until the days of Artaxerxes the first. So according to this chronology, the Jews are present from the year 539 before the Common Era for a period of as much as potentially 100 years before there's any opposition whatsoever. Then you have opposition in the days of Artaxerxes. That opposition lasts into the reign of Darius II, right, which you see there. And then finally, Ezra is not sent until at the earliest 404 before the Common Era. In other words, Jews have been in the land for 130 years plus before Ezra ever shows up, according to this read, if you're going to make this work with the secular chronology. You follow? Now, actually using that, you might begin to understand I'm not sure that this is correct. But one of the problems that we've talked about off and on is the missing 165 years. The fact that we only mentioned 4 Persian kings, but there were an awful lot spanning a long period of time. So one of the answers that's offered, the answer given by Rav Shimon Schwab at one point, although I think he recanted eventually, was to suggest that it took a long time to build the second temple, and that our chronology sandwiches all of that together and skips the long period that elapses. Well, now I understand where the long period that elapses is. According to this, you've got 130 years going on before Ezra even makes it, and they're only building the walls of Jerusalem after that. Something to think about. The bottom line is that we've seen 3 approaches, all from traditional sources, all of them committed to retaining the chronology of the book. They don't want the book to go out of order. That's something that clearly is valued. So the only ways I can do this are to take the first view, which compresses everything into one king. It's all one guy. No problem. Everything happening from the beginning of our book, really, all the way until you get to chapter 6, sentence 22, is all in the reign of one man. That's the Medrash and Seder Olam. That's the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah. That's Rashi. You follow? Everything happened together. That's one approach. Second approach is to say, Mitzudat David's approach, that it is happening in the reign of two kings. One king who is Cyrus, from the beginning of our book until chapter 4, sentence... depending on who that Artaxerxes is, it's still Cyrus. So until chapter 5. Then chapter 5 starts with Darius, and that's your second king. And that will last until the end of chapter 6. So you have two kings who sum up everything, and their overall title is Artaxerxes. So either you have one king through this period, or you have two kings through this period. And then the Baal HaMa'or, who says, no, it's 4 different kings that we're actually dealing with, 3 for this period of time until chapter 7. Your first one is Cyrus. Your second one is now Artaxerxes, Artaxerxes the first. And then your third one is going to be Darius the second. You follow? I feel like I'm losing people, but I'm doing the best I can with this. The only thing that he has to do in order to make this work is that the line in chapter 4, sentence 24, which says the opposition lasts until the second year of King Darius, is speaking forward in time, because that hasn't happened yet. That's one blip. But it works in terms of the order of the kings, if you just say they're all different people. It works in terms of chapter 6, sentence 14, that listed Darius, Cyrus, and Artaxerxes. Yeah, they're all different people. I have no problem listing each of them. It works very nicely in that sense.
So during 130 years, there's four kings.
Yeah.
And that's when all the rebellions...
And possibly more in between, we just don't mention.
So the opposition went through four kings, the people were there, there was different generations, right?
Well, the opposition, according to this, only begins in the period of Artaxerxes, who is the third of the four kings.
Oh, I see.
Cyrus's time is fine, Darius is fine, his time is Artaxerxes when this all begins.
Okay.
Artaxerxes the first, which will actually help solve a problem that Malbim is going to raise, which I'll note now, but we're going to have to see it inside, which is, what we're going to see is that Cyrus allowed this. He allowed the construction, right? Then, along came the Samaritans and said, well, we don't like this construction. We're going to write a letter to the king. And it's going to work. They're actually going to halt our construction. Tell me something. You've all, I hope, at some point or another, learned the Book of Esther. What is the rule regarding royal decrees?
No backsies,
Shana says. That is exactly right. You don't get to undo a royal decree. So how does it happen, according to these other answers, that Cyrus issues a decree and either he himself backs out, if I take the Gemara's view, right? He is Darius and Artaxerxes. He issues a decree and then he backs out. Or, alternatively, right after his time in the next king, they're going to walk this back. Now, you could say, well, maybe Ahasuerus made it up because he didn't like the idea of backing down on his word because he has insecurity issues in general. And that could be. That comes through pretty clearly in the book.
No lower judge?
No, he didn't need a lower judge. He didn't need a judge to overturn his decree. They're not an option.
The Supreme Court.
No. He's a ridiculous judge. You can't accept him. No. Checks and balances are foreign to Ahasuerus. That is a problem. How are they rescinding the decree? But if I take the view of Rabbi Zrachya Halevi, right, this Baal HaMor third view, that this is playing out over a period of 130 years, yeah, there's a statute of limitations. 130 years later, you can undo the permission that was given long before. That makes more sense in terms of the reversal of the decree.
Seems to me in a king's life, in an emperor's life, he's infallible, he can't change it. But it doesn't seem to me that a next king cannot change a previous king's position. Often, he may have killed the best king, or he may have conquered the country.
If we want to come up with an honest answer to this question, we really need to learn Persian history and find out what the royal policies were. Everything we have on this is supposition beyond the text that we have in Esther. I would like Ezra to be consistent with Esther. But not knowing what actually happened in the reign of different kings and between kings. What do I know? Sorry?
The dates of authorship.
So that's part of the problem. Yeah.
I just want to know, was it, I don't know the narrative here, was there an about face or was there...
We're going to see it, but there's an about face.
Oh, okay.
We allowed you to build, now we don't allow you to build.
Use a loophole to kind of...
Right, no. We let you build and now we're not going to.
Uh-huh.
Eventually. When we check the records.
About face, well, that's
the question. If you take the Gemara's view, it's the same king.
Right, but we're not sure.
Well, because we have different views. Right. We haven't even gotten to the fourth one yet. The fourth one, quite frankly, is the simplest read. It's the simplest read of all. It just requires that you give up on the chronology of the book. But it makes sense. This is the view that's put forth in the Dan Mikra edition by Mordechai Zer Kavod. And others lean this way. And I think there's a lot to recommend it. I listened at one point to a shiur by Professor Chaim Angel on this, and he liked this view too. If you take a look at source number 8, I copied in from Professor Zer Kavod's account of this. He says, keep in mind what our text did. you have to keep in mind what we read last week, where we said that the Jews start to build, and then the Samaritans get involved, and the Samaritans want to participate with them or want to slow them down, however you read that. And the Jews said, no, we're good, we're on our own, we're building this under permission given to us by Cyrus. And so they say, ha, we'll show you. And they hire their lobbyists and they intimidate, right? That was what we saw in chapter 4, sentence 5. And then in sentence 6 we said, and this, already in sentence 5, I should say, it said, and this would continue until the reign of Darius and the king of Ahasuerus and so on. Says Zer Kavod, once we start on the discussion of obstacles, we then bring in chapter 4, sentences 7 to 23, an account of a later obstacle that was created, only to show you, like, this is a type of thing that they did. And then, after we're done in sentence 23 with this, we now go back to the way things were, and we go back to the time of King Darius. The story got put back here because it fit thematically. That's the idea. Take a look again in source number 3, please. Number 3 being the cycle of kings, the order of kings. So, according to him, we have our whole business of Cyrus. Then we jump ahead. Once we've mentioned there's opposition that runs until the time of Darius, we have a story from later on in the time of Artaxerxes the First, and then we jump back to Darius the First. You follow? And if you take a look in the outline in number 2, the outline of the verses, now you see it clearly. Opposition from the time of Cyrus to the time of Darius, opposition in the time of Ahasuerus, opposition in the future time of Artaxerxes, lasts until the second year of Darius, is now already taking us back into the time of Darius, who we'll then see them dealing with in chapter 5 through chapter 6, sentence 13. So if you flip the page for the last time to number 9, that's our fourth solution. Chapter 4, sentences 7 to 23 is brought from later in history. That makes that a lot simpler, right? Just bringing that piece from later, it's a flash forward, exactly. Now you'll say to me, why would they do that? But the answer is that happens a lot in Tanakh. That's not only something you see here. In Sefer Shoftim, for example, we move things around to the end, specifically the story of Pesel Micha, the story of Pilegish Begiva, the concubine Agiva, those appear at the end of Shoftim, but they don't happen there. They happen during the book. They're there at the end because we want to show the descent of the Jews before we get to the story of Shmuel, the coronation of Shaul and David HaMelech, and the climb out of the pit that they've been in. But it didn't happen at the end. It was moved there because thematically it made sense. So the argument goes that can happen in Navi, and it can certainly happen in Ketuvim when you're dealing with Sefer Ezra. He's simply fitting with the theme, because now we're talking about the stumbling blocks that were in our way. Clear? So again, you have four solutions, and they can all be summed up in a sentence. The first solution is everything here is one king. It's all one king. Don't worry about his names. It's all one king.
Over 130 years?
Well, no, because that's a secular chronology. Their argument is we don't believe in that chronology. We believe that it's one man. The second approach is that your first part is Cyrus as Artaxerxes. If Artaxerxes is the word king, it's Artaxerxes Cyrus, followed by Artaxerxes Darius. And then some later Artaxerxes will appear later on, who's going to let Ezra come to Israel, and then Nehemiah as well. Your third approach is, these are four kings. Cyrus, Artaxerxes, Darius, Artaxerxes. And read it all straight in order, and it just takes a lot of time. And then your fourth approach is the approach to say that this section here, this slice of history with Artaxerxes, was brought here because it fit the general context of the obstructions of building, and then we go back to dealing with what's happening earlier in time. I hope that helped. If not, you can always watch the recording, listen to the audio, and maybe rewind a couple of times. But those are your four basic approaches to the problem. Again, the problem we're trying to solve is that chapter 4, sentences 7 to 23, talk about what's happening in the time of Artaxerxes, But before that, we were in Cyrus's time. Later than that, we're in Darius's time. And our Tachshasta shouldn't be here. That's the way we deal with it. Shena and then Elisheva.
Is there anything helpful to be drawn from the switch from Hebrew to Aramaic in the narrative?
Not so much, unfortunately. We will switch from Hebrew to Aramaic in the narrative, as Shena points out, because we are going to refer to the Aramaic letter that is sent from the Samaritans to the Persians. No, Persians don't speak Aramaic. We're going to have to come back to that. But we switch to Aramaic to record that passage, and that's why we end up much as we did in Daniel, when we recorded a text of Nebuchadnezzar in Aramaic, and then we stuck with it for a few chapters. That's the way that's how that works, but it doesn't help us in terms of the time frame, I think. Elisheva.
Okay, I don't know if this is too confusing, but essentially that even Exposition 4 still preserves the chronology, it just brings the story up, but this chronology is still preserved. So it doesn't change chronology still, it still sticks with it.
Right, what I mean when I say it changes the chronology, I mean that imagine that you had on the side of your screen as you were watching this book the date. And you suddenly hit chapter 4, sentence 7, the date would change forward. And then when you hit sentence 24, the date would change back. That's what I mean by altering the chronology. Okay.
Rashi usually loves playing with numbers, especially in the Gemara. And I don't see any numbers here in Rashi. Could we deduce that Rashi perhaps was also really struggling?
What do you mean by numbers? What do you mean by playing with numbers?
Again and again, he will calculate dates and he'll calculate the different things. In terms of when you stretch 7 here and you add 4 there and things like that.
Well,
he does it many times.
Right, well, I don't think he needs to. In other words, since he is bringing us the Gemara's version of it, for him it's actually very straightforward. They're all one king. What does he need to play? You know, he doesn't need to say anything about what year it is. To him, this is all happening in the same lifetime of the same king, and he's very happy. There's nothing for him to do. He's almost bored. Okay, so now that we've spent 40 minutes with, you know, the royal mess, as I call it, let's actually see what happens in this interlude, this sentences 7 to 23, in which the Samaritans send their letter to Artaxasta, which, and this is the key thing that you need to know and that you need to be paying attention to, either this is a letter sent when they're building the Beis HaMikdash, building the temple, and everybody is, you know, they're trying to stop, Samaritans are trying to stop the Jews from building the temple, or this is brought from later on when they're building up the city itself and the walls, and the Samaritans want to prevent the building of the walls of Jerusalem. Because walls will allow you to defend the city, walls are a point of pride for a city, walls are a very big deal, even back then. So, take a look, please, at chapter 4, sentence 7. If you are using the Stone Tanakh, you want page 1821. We're going to read through sentences 7 to 16 first, I think. Or maybe even just 7 to 11. Maybe we'll just do 7 to 11 first. Bless you. Ubimei Artaxasta. In the days of King Artaxasta, Artaxerxes, Kasav Bishlam Misradas Tavel Ushar Knavosav, and yes, this is Aramaic, Al Artaxasta Melech Paras, Uchsav Anishtaban Kasuv Aramis Umsurgam Aramis. I'm pronouncing it in fine Ashkenazi Babylonian. Do with it what you will. In the days of Artaxasta, we get a letter written by some people. We have to come back to those names and their allies, their friends, to Artaxasta, king of Persia. And the text of the letter was written in Aramaic script and translated or expressed in the language of Aramaic. Rechum be'el te'em. Rechum, the man of the order, Te'im being power to issue an order, or alternatively, a man of reason, Vishimshai Safra, and a scribe by the name of Shimshai, who the Medrash actually says is the son of Haman, interestingly, Ksavu Igra Chada al Yerushalayim, they wrote a letter against Jerusalem, L'Artaxasta Malka, to the king Artaxasta, Kenema. Kenema is like Lemur, saying. Nema in Aramaic is let us say. So they sent a letter saying the following. If you were with us when we did Daniel, right? There are some people here who were with us when we did, when we learned Daniel. The enjambment method of writing letters is very prominent there as well. Meaning, you write a letter and the last word or two in your sentence leads into the next sentence. So these people wrote a letter saying, a dayin rechum be'el te'em v'shimshai safra ushar k'navas hon. A dayin, a word you'll remember from Daniel, is us. Then. So then, rechum and Shimshai and their friends, k'navas hon, by the way, is a word you know from Hebrew, from Chumash. If you remember Yosef speaking to the brothers, im kenim atem. Right? To be kain, right? Bekenut. Is to be honest, to be open, to be a friend, as it's used here, to be an ally. Those who are honest with them, they're friends. So, Ushark Navazon. And who are their friends? Oh boy. Dinaye, judges. Va'afarsas chaye. The plural in general is the ye ending. You're just going to see that a lot. Yeah, no, not a farsakim. These are not peaches. There are some kind of hyper officer, the apar, I think. These are some kind of great officer. I think they actually tell you in the Dad Mikra, Sha'ar HaPikidim, other officers. Yeah, okay, it's some position. Tarplaye, as well as, now we're going to mention Tarplaye. Tarplaye is a reference to the residents of Tarpale, which is the area on this side of the Jordan River. And now we're going to get a bunch of populations, some of which you'll recognize. Afarsaye, citizens of Persia. Arkavaye, citizens of Erech. Bavlaye, Babylonians. Shushanchaye, residents of Shushan. Very good. Dehaye, residents of Dehaya. Elmaye, and residents of Elam. Why are we mentioning all these people? Sentence 10. Ushar Umaya and the other nations, Dihagli Asnapar Rabba Viakira, which the great and wonderful Asnapar exiled, the Hosev Himo Bekiria di Shamrayin, and he planted them all in the Shamron. In other words, in the name of all of those different groups who were picked up by that great and wonderful king who exiled us and planted us here in the Shomron. Remember that we noted way back when that the exiling of populations to the Shomron occurs over a long period of time. It isn't one particular one. And that's why we list more nations here than we saw in Malachim Bet who were brought there. There we have this other list of nations. And also this is a new king. Asnapar is not the one who we mentioned before, because there was a cycle of kings. We talked about Sargon. We had Shalmaneser. We had Sancheirib. We had others. So this is Asnapar. He, in his glory, sent us here. Ushar Avarnara and the rest of the area on the western side of the Jordan. Ucheenes. Ucheenes is either a place or Keenes is. And now I'm about to tell you something. The word ke'an, kaf ayin nun in Aramaic, is now, like achshav. So, in the name of all of these different populations, here's what we're doing here. Dinap harshegen igarta. Here is the text of the letter. Dishalachu aloi al artachshasta malka, which they sent to King Artachshasta, avdoch enosh avar nahara, your servants, the people of the western side of the Jordan, uche enes. And again, either that's a place, or and now. And now we're actually going to get to the letter. It took us that many sentences just to actually get to the text of this letter that they sent. But I already have a problem. Who sent the letter? Don't list all the populations. Who are the individuals who sent the letter? No, the people. What are their names?
Shishai and
Rechum. Then who are the people in sentence 7? What happened to Mitredat? There are way too many names in this story. What in the world is going on? Why do I have so many names? No, seriously, what happened here?
Well,
so first of all,
that was a scribe.
one actually did the writing.
That's right. That's Shimshai.
Yeah, somebody dictated it.
Okay, and then you have Rehum, who's the man of counsel or the man with the orders. Okay, but who are these people in sentence 7 then? Especially, who's the first one? What is the name of the first writer? No, not the king. Mitredat is the first one? Is that what all your translations say? Oh, so here we have a problem. So the word Bishlam could legitimately be the name of a letter writer, right? Or, according to Rashi, it's with the peaceful greetings of Mitredat and so on. We even have a debate among the commentaries as to whether it's Bishlam is the greeting of, and then Mitredat is one person and Tav'el is another person, or whether it's Mitredat Tav'el, that they're actually, you know, it's part of the same name. That I don't want you to get hung up on. That's not a big deal.
Could they have sent a greeting that was followed by a letter? Like the greeting of
people? Theoretically. Theoretically. It's odd, but it could be. This is a mess. So Rashi takes the view that the people who are in sentence 7 are the drafters of the letter. They're the ones who actually draft the letter. And then Rehum and Shimshai in sentence 8 are the scribes. There's a scribe and then there's an overscribe. And that's one way to look at it. But I really liked what Malbim did with this. Malbim said, no, you're reading this story wrong. Take a look, please, at number 11, source number 11 on your sheet. First of all, number 10 is Mitzudat David explaining how Rehum is called the Baal Taim, the person of wisdom or something. He says, yeah, he knows how to arrange a text of the letter, meaning he's the one who can put this into a proper argument. Like, you know what you want to say, but he's the one who knows how to present it, and then Shimshai is the one who can write it in, you know, beautiful calligraphy. So everyone's got their specialty. Yeah.
So this is like in the Gemara where it says, my time, what is the argument for something?
Yes, exactly. So take a look, though, at number 11, where Malbim tells you what's going on. I made a point of saying, way back when, before we confused all the kings, what was it that I made a point of?
You confused yourself.
Yeah, that didn't take long. I made the point of saying, back in the beginning when we were going to play this out, that the letter, well, first of all, the letter is going to be written in Aramaic, right? Even though Persians don't speak Aramaic. But there was also something from the beginning that made sense to fit with this. I don't remember what it was. All right, it was a little bit of foreshadowing that is now, oh, I know. Back in sentence 5, they hired Yoatzim, they hired lobbyists. What are the lobbyists doing? So Malbim is the one who explains what the lobbyists are for. Take a look at number 11 now. Now it's all together. Achar shekoresh zeh be'atzmo nasan das livnoso. He first asks his question, which we've already asked. The bolding in the Hebrew is mine. He says, Cyrus himself gave the order to build it. Va'amar shashem pakar alav livnos lo bayis. He said, God told me to build it. Eich b'yamim mu'atim hechziris hadasu b'tel abinyan. How is it that in a short period of time, he recanted? And he said, no, don't build, because that's what's going to happen. V'yadanu ki b'dasei parasum v'day kol ksav asher nechtav b'shem ha'melech lo yachol ha'melech levat lo b'shum ofen. The king can't cancel out his decree. Kimavur Benyan Daniel. We see it in Daniel Perek Vav when Daniel is thrown into the lion's den and the king doesn't want to do it. Darius the Mede apparently, doesn't want to throw him in the lion's den, but he doesn't have a choice. Ubinyan Achashverosh and famously Megillat Esther. So he says that's one problem. Zos Shanis, and he says I have a second problem, which is, I'm going to say it in brief because of the time. It's the point that we've already noted that they're going to say the Jews are building the wall of the temple, of the city. But they're not. This is the early stage. Unless you accept Dat Mikra's read, which Malbim does not, this is occurring during the construction of the temple, not the construction of the walls of the city, but they're going to say it's the walls of the city that are being built. So his answer begins at the words, Al-Piash Elo Ta'ela, or if you're using the English, based on these questions, the third paragraph in the English. Based on these questions, Ya'ir Lanu or Beferu Shaksuv Mo'ela, we get some light on these verses. Shabamis Nasa Vazem Mirma Gedola, there was a great trick that happened here. Vayade Shokad Mamon, there was a bribe. Shanasnut Sare Yehuda, which was given by the enemies of Yehuda. Sachru yoatzim, they hired counselors, lobbyists, v'hitzliach mirma biyadam, and their trick succeeded. What do you mean? He says the Persian Empire is this huge empire. And you had all these different lands in which everybody spoke their own language. So the rule was, you write to the king in your own language. You don't have to know Persian. And that's why I made a point in the text that it's written in Aramaic and in the Aramaic script. And there were two officers in each land whose job was to translate. They're the diplomats. They translate the letter from the original into Persian, and then when the king's response comes, they translate the response back into the local language. And he says, making a long story short, that's what Rechum and Shimshai are there for. They're not agents of the Samaritans. They're agents of the Persian government. But what we're going to see, it's going to play out next week, is that they're on the take from the Samaritans. And what they're going to do is change the letter in such a way that it will make the Jews look bad, but if they get caught, they will have plausible deniability.
Yeah.
That's what you'll see. It's going to be next week. You have to wait on tenterhooks for next week. But that's what's happening here. It's all part of the plot. And that, frankly, is the smoothest read of why I have two sets of names here. The answer is, the first set of names are the Samaritans. The ones who are writing the letter are the ones who are translating it into Persian so that it can go off to the palace. So what we've seen now is, really, we learned two things today in the past hour. Number one is that a chunk of Perek Dalet, a chunk of chapter 4, is going to talk about opposition to the construction in the time of Artaxasta. Either it's opposition to the construction of the temple as part of this period of time, and the names are scrambled in different ways, or this is a piece taken from later on when they're building the walls of Jerusalem, and it's brought here because we're talking about ways in which we were opposed. That was all what we learned in the first 40 minutes. And then the second piece that we have is that they sent off this letter in whatever time this is to King Artaxasta. It was written by the Samaritans and all of their various friends, but it was, they're all Samaritan, and given to these Persian scribes, whose job is to translate it into Persian to go to the king, and there's a scam going on in the way that they're going to that the translation will be done, which, God willing, we will get to next week.